Hi, Sayward.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and in fact, this is actually Worldwise. That's what this is. This is an episode of Worldwise. I got mixed up between the two things I do. But you are in, of all places, Kosovo.
That's correct, yes. Actually, 1 month today I've been living here.
Wow. And was that your first time there?
This is my second time in the Balkans. I worked here as a journalist a couple of years ago, but I was actually here right after Kosovo declared independence, and so I wasn't able to come into the country. The program I was with was nervous about the situation. So this is my first time in Kosovo, but I have worked around the region before.
Okay, and you work for an NGO?
I do. I work for a human rights group here called Youth Initiative for Human Rights. It's actually a regional network. They have offices in Pristina, where I am, Belgrade, Sarajevo, Zagreb. And I'm also working as a freelance journalist while I'm here, so I'm juggling both roles.
Right, okay. And you're going to bring us up to date on Kosovo, which is good because Americans tend to forget about places that they have a big impact on shortly after having the impact.
Yes.
And back in the 90s, we had a pretty big impact. You may have to help me kind of brush up on the details, but basically, a lot of people in Kosovo wanted to secede from Serbia, which they were then part of.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And there was this thing, the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was like a guerrilla force trying to accelerate that change.
Mm-hmm.
We intervened on behalf, against Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
It was an air only intervention. We didn't put boots on the ground during the conflict, I don't think.
Correct.
Then I guess you could fast forward to, you just alluded to the Declaration of Independence, right?
Mm-hmm.
When that was 2008, and
that's
you were
right
there then?
In February of 2008, and I was actually here or in the Balkans in March, so very soon after.
Okay. So what is the status now? I noticed, I tried to call you on Skype and noticed that Kosovo doesn't seem to have its own country code. What is exactly the legal status of Kosovo these days?
Well, it's tricky, and it depends on who you ask. You're correct that the United States, or NATO, intervened in 1999, which ended the conflict between Kosovo and Serbia. And there's been an international presence on the ground ever since. And in 2008, Kosovo unilaterally declared independence from Serbia, and they consider themselves an independent state. I believe around 90 countries have now recognized Kosovo as independent, including most prominently the United States, and the vast majority of EU members, although I believe there are 5 holdouts at this point, including Spain and Greece. And obviously places like Serbia have not recognized it. So today it really depends. Some people consider it a full state. Other people still consider it a province of Serbia. Other people sort of see it as being in this quasi-state position. So it's definitely unique in that sense, and it presents a lot of unique challenges for people living and working here. But I know that Kosovo feels very strongly about its independence. Serbia feels very strongly about it not having independence, and that's definitely the biggest point of political contention around here right now.
Mm-hmm. And I assume you are warmly received as an American by most people there?
Oh, definitely. As you enter the city, there's actually a statue of Bill Clinton waving, and he sits on Bill Clinton Boulevard. And there's also a 3-story high, I believe, photo of him behind the statue. So he's right there. And then actually Bill Clinton Boulevard intersects with George W. Bush Boulevard, I believe. And then there's also, I've heard, a Bob Dole Boulevard. So America is looked upon very fondly in a historical sense, but also being an American here, there are a lot of Americans here. And I would say we're received very, very warmly by locals. The day that I moved in, the person whose flat I was renting took a day off of work to show me around the city, take me to get a SIM card, things like that. So I think generally people here are very friendly to Americans.
And what city are you in?
I'm in the capital, which is Pristina. Some people call it Pristine. And it is by far the largest city in Kosovo. Kosovo is not a very big place. I think there are about 2 million people total in the country. And the vast majority of people, I would guess, live here in Pristina.
Okay. And is it now perfectly safe and stable? I mean, the Serbs have given up?
No, I mean, certainly where I am is quite safe, but there are, particularly in northern Kosovo, there's a town called Mitrovica, which is, I want to say, about an hour north of Pristina, near the Serbian border, and actually it continues to be an extremely tense place. It is divided between ethnic Serbs and ethnic Albanians, and NATO has a fairly strong presence there still.
And we should say maybe that the Kosovars, is that the name for people in Kosovo, Kosovars, or am I confused?
Kosovars, yes.
Mm-hmm. Kosovars. The Kosovars who won an independence were ethnically Albanian, by and large,
that's,
right?
That's correct, and by and large, ethnic Serbs did not want independence. Right. And in the north, the people who, the ethnic Serbs living there feel very strongly about not accepting the authority of the government in Pristina, and that is what leads to tension. And actually, the last year has been particularly active on that front. A few times in the second half of 2011, there were clashes between ethnic Serbs and NATO troops. And as recently as about 2 weeks ago, there were clashes. No one was killed, but a couple of people were injured. Essentially, the NATO troops went in and tried to remove roadblocks that the ethnic Serbs had put up. The ethnic Serbs threw things at them. I think gunfire was exchanged potentially, and there were a couple of injuries. So it definitely continues to be a very tense place. I mean, people live and work there normally, but there's definitely still a military presence and a lot happening.
So the Serbs up there now feel maybe a little the way the ethnic Albanians felt about Serbia before they got their own place, right?
Sure. I mean, I guess the big difference in that is that the well, let me say this. There are some interesting parallels. In the 1990s, the Albanians in Kosovo set up what are known as parallel structures or parallel institutions. And these were essentially governance institutions, so administrations, schools, things like that, that they considered their own and separate from Serbia's. This was a huge point of contention between people here and Serbia. And today, the Serbs in the north have their own parallel institutions that sort of mimic what happened in the 90s, just in reverse. And it's, again, causing a lot of problems. But the big difference, I think, today is that, obviously, Slobodan Milosevic actually was actively violent toward the Albanian people in Kosovo, whereas today the Serbs in the north are certainly upset about being included in what they don't believe to be an independent state, but they're also not under military attack. And so sentiment might be the same, but the circumstances are pretty different.
Yeah, I mean, I assume, wasn't Milosevic saying at the time that there was actually an armed insurrection, that he was... I mean, the Kosovo Liberation Army. I don't know which came first. You know, I don't know how it's a little like all these things are. But
sure.
But his claim was that he was suppressing an actual armed rebellion, and the Kosovo Liberation Army was an armed force, right?
That's correct. And actually, today a lot of people from the KLA continue to be active. The Prime Minister actually was kind of a key political member of the KLA. And so Kosovo is an interesting case study in how you get an armed group to disarm and actually turn to politics as opposed to action. They've actually been working with some members of the insurrection in Libya and Syria to sort of share ideas about how you move from resistance to governance, which is quite interesting.
And this is the Syrian thing in particular is looked upon askance by Russia, which, of course, has historical reasons to not be enthusiastic about the Kosovo situation to begin with.
Right.
Since they were on the other side of it. It was in the backdrop of Kosovo versus Serbia was this great power tension between the United States and Russia. So there was this. I think maybe you wrote about this,
right? I did, yes.
About Russia spreading the idea that there was really quite active involvement of I guess the coast of a government in helping the Syrian insurrection, or what? What was the claim?
So the claim was that the Kosovo government was training, like militarily training insurgents from Syria. And obviously Russia opposes intervention in Syria. They also oppose Kosovo's independence, so this is just a cluster of issues for them. But they went on record at the UN in May, I believe, saying, you know, if in fact, and we believe, Kosovo is training militants, you know, this is wildly problematic. And I spoke to people in NATO, and I spoke to people in the foreign ministry here, and they have said unequivocally, you know, we are not in any way training anyone. We wouldn't even have the capacity to train anyone. What they have done, however, is been very vocally supportive of the Syrian opposition, as well as the Libyan opposition when they were still active, and not actually the government. And they, in late April, brought in a group of Syrian activists, I think three of them, and had a series of meetings. And again, the discussion was more about how do you move from resistance to governance? You know, how do you go from a situation in which you're fighting to remove something that is oppressing you to actually governing yourselves? And so they spoke with various government officials. They visited a couple of towns in Kosovo, including some that were pretty badly damaged during the conflict. And then they also met with former KLA members, again, to discuss sort of the transition from fighting to being a part of politics. But again, you know, Russia has said what they think, and the Kosovo government has said that's not true. And as far as I can tell, there is no evidence that they, you know, are opening training camps for militants, which is what Russia thinks.
I see. But there is ongoing consultation.
Yeah,
it sounds like.
It's diplomatic, I think. And when I spoke to the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs here, you know, he said they were brought in by civil society, they were brought in by a foreign policy organization here, and they did meet with government officials, and the foreign minister himself has gone on record and said we support them because they're fighting for the same values we were fighting for. But again, I think the connection is diplomatic, and it's certainly meant to be instructive in that Kosovo maybe has a unique position in the world in terms of the success that it had. And so they feel as though they have lessons that they can share, both, you know, mistakes that were made and successes that were achieved.
Okay. Now, on this, back to this kind of relationship between Serbia and Kosovo. Mm-hmm. So first of all, these ethnic Serbs, I gather they are not kind of conveniently in a, you know, in a homogeneous area that happens to be immediately adjacent to Serbia itself. So there's not like the simple solution of just redrawing a boundary, right?
Right, and even if it were so simple as, well, let's just, you know, loop them in, obviously that, or at least the argument that is made by people who are very much opposed to that, is that, especially in the Balkans, you run into a dangerous precedent of saying, okay, well, every time an ethnic group doesn't like the border, we're going to redraw it, and then essentially you have ethnically pure states. And you just keep whittling down and whittling down, and that, you know, obviously undermines any project of multiculturalism and coexistence. And so, you know, even if it were potentially a seemingly simple solution, it actually would have ramifications, I think, that would be troubling.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's not that simple, right?
No,
I mean, there are, even within individual towns or villages,
right,
there are both ethnic Albanians and Serbs.
That's correct. I mean, they often live in enclaves. You know, they live
mm-hmm.
in neighborhoods almost. I was actually driving recently with colleagues to another town, and we were driving through, you know, a part of a small municipality, and a friend said, this is a Serb area. And actually you could tell because it switched, like signs switched to using Cyrillic as opposed to the Latin alphabet. So you knew that there were more Serbs there than, for instance, in Pristina, where it's, you know, mostly Albanian.
Mm-hmm. And do Serb politicians still talk about aspirations to reclaim Kosovo? Is that a big issue in Serbia?
Definitely. I mean, depending on who you talk to, but most of the high-level politicians in Serbia see this as a, you know, we're never going to recognize Kosovo. It's just not going to happen. And this comes from the president, this comes from the foreign minister, this comes from everybody high up you can imagine. For them, this is you know, seemingly non-negotiable, and they are quite vehement about it. And this is a sticking point for them because they also want to join the European Union, and the EU has made it clear that they need to normalize relations with Kosovo, if not recognize Kosovo before they would accede to the EU, at least figure out some sort of situation where this antagonism is not so strong. These parallel structures that exist in the north are not receiving money from Belgrade, which they currently do, quite a lot of money, actually. And so this is a very, very sticky situation, both between the two countries, but then between the countries and, you know, broader Europe.
So by parallel structures, you mean like school system,
right?
And so like for Serbs in northern Kosovo would be actually paid for, is currently subsidized by the Serbian government.
Correct. That's correct.
And do the politicians ever go beyond saying we won't recognize them and say, you know, the day will come when we will take, you know, the troops will head south and...
I certainly haven't heard anything. I think that given their EU aspirations, mm-hmm. again, you're not going to hear anybody... who would be involved in talking with the EU, so very, very high-up politicians, mm-hmm. you know, threatening any sort of military action. At this point, it's highly political. And they actually recently elected a new president in Serbia, which is pretty big news down in this region because he's a very hardline nationalist. I mean, he does want to join the EU, mm-hmm. but he's also, I mean, he was a former... you know, he was a Milosevic supporter back many, many years ago. And he came out very quickly and said, you know, we will not recognize Kosovo. He met with Serb leaders from the north of Kosovo, I believe within the first week of being president, and has generally kind of sent some shockwaves through the region with his rhetoric. Again, all the time balancing and saying, but we do want to be a part of the EU. So, again, it's a very, very sticky situation.
Mm-hmm. And he got into some controversy with some remarks about the atrocities committed, I guess, against Bosnians. Was it against Bosnians?
Yes,
or,
yes. Mm-hmm. So he was, I believe, in an interview with Montenegrin television. There's so many countries around here. I believe it was in an interview in Montenegro, and he went on record and said that Srebrenica is not a genocide, and Srebrenica was a massacre in 1995 of some 7,500, 8,000 Muslim men and boys in Bosnia mm-hmm. By Serb troops. And it's been recognized by, I believe, three international courts now as a genocide. But he said that he does not believe it is one, which made people quite angry. He made some other choice comments. I believe he claimed that a town that's actually a Croatian town was a Serbian town. It was very, you know, mm-hmm. backward-looking in terms of, you know, historical events. But it led to many leaders in the region not attending his inauguration. And has certainly been highly controversial.
Did he claim that these 8,000 people weren't even killed?
No, he's just denying that it was a genocide. And I think he's very much appealing to a base in doing that. Mm-hmm. Again, he's kind of a hardline nationalist in comparison certainly to his predecessor, who was more friendly to the West. And I think it was sort of an acknowledgement to those supporters of, you know, I'm with you.
Is he acknowledging that these were basically unarmed people who were slaughtered?
You know, I don't know the exact text of the entire interview. The quote that's been repeated again and again in various press accounts is that, you know, I don't believe it was a genocide. And so I don't know what his views are fully on the entire event. But I think it's a very sensitive issue because, you know, genocide obviously carries a lot of weight rhetorically, politically, legally, otherwise, you know, and to say that it's not is to fly in the face of what international courts have said, but also to fly in the face of survivors, their families, and it's definitely disruptive, I think, politically to the region because so much reconciliation is still going on. There were mm-hmm. actually two indictments, two more indictments in Srebrenica issued this week for two more potential perpetrators. And so, you know, this is an ongoing, even though it was, you know, almost 20 years ago at this point, it's still very much in the news and very much, you know, in people's minds and emotions.
Okay, so this is complicated, the Serbian aspiration to be in the European Union. These remarks, among other things.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Croatia is set to join the EU in 2013, and Serbia feels as though, you know, it's ready to kind of move along that path as well. But there are these issues related to Kosovo. For a long time, it was related to the arrest of war criminals, but they've actually, in the past couple of years, arrested two of the main perpetrators who were on the loose. So, you know, the EU is definitely there, dangling. But I actually spoke to an EU representative based here in the Balkans last week, and I asked him about how various countries were sort of moving on the path, and then my last one was Serbia, and he kind of shrugged and he said, well, you know, we're still working on Serbia. And the implication, as we continued to talk, was that the election of this new president, Nikolic is his name, is certainly troubling. I don't know if I'd call it a setback per se. I don't think it's clear yet exactly because he's only been in office a bit. But it definitely makes their EU aspirations all the trickier.
Uh-huh. And you don't happen to know, do you, whether they and, for that matter, Croatia, but plan to actually enter the monetary union? In other words, adopt the euro as opposed to just belonging to
right.
the union in the sense that Britain does?
That's a really good question. I do not know. I would guess not the eurozone immediately. You know, the last enlargement that took place didn't automatically come with eurozone status. And, I think Slovakia jumped in, Czech Republic didn't, you know, it just depends. So I don't think, especially given the current situation, I think that it's more related to the other aspects of the EU, but I'm also not an economic specialist, so I wouldn't want to speculate, you know, more on what they aspire to in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And so meanwhile, over in Serbia, mm-hmm. it sounds like the people in power are people that Milosevic himself would approve of, judging by remarks such as the ones we just discussed, what is the political situation there? It's a true functioning democracy, I take it?
Yeah, it is a functioning democracy, and, you know, in this region it's tricky in that, you know, people who supported someone 15 years ago may have a very different, you know, stance now. So Nikolic, even, although he is much more nationalist than his predecessor, who was named Tadic, he's certainly not, I think, as nationalistic as he used to be. You know, it's an ever-evolving political situation. Now, that's not to say that, you know, some of his ideas might be troubling if you disagree with the nationalists in Serbia. But I do think that, you know, it's hard to compare someone from 15 years ago in this region to now, because so much has happened, mm-hmm. and people have picked up views, lost views. You know, it really depends on mm-hmm. the individual.
Do you encounter ethnic Serbs yourself?
That's a good question. I know that I have. I mean, certainly in day-to-day here, it's predominantly Albanian. A lot of people can speak Serbian because, you know, growing up, for instance, my landlady, her husband said, you know, when I was growing up, I had to go to school and learn Serbian, and now, you know, mm-hmm. they don't have to do that. But I have not, I think in official government settings, in a couple of, like, parliamentary meetings I've been to report or to be there for my organization, you always have things translated into Serbian because there are stipulations in the legislation here in Kosovo about the number of Serbs that have to, you know, serve in legislative positions. And so there's always someone there who speaks Serbian. My organization translates all of its documents into Serbian. And so, you know, there's definitely a strong sense of we are multicultural, like we preserve that. But at the same mm-hmm. time, you know, wandering around, you mostly hear Albanian speaking, or spoken, rather, I'm sorry. I'm planning to go to Mitrovica in the next week or so, which, again, is where there's a Serb enclave. And there, you know, I expect to hear and see much more of a Serb presence.
So you haven't yet had the experience of walking up to an ethnic Serb and saying, hi, I'm from America?
No, I haven't. I do have several friends from Serbia, just, you know, in the U.S., and they're all lovely people, and so I would in no way want to, you know, make assumptions, but no, I haven't, so we'll see how that goes when I go up to Mitrovica.
It may be a different reception than the one you've gotten from the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo.
Potentially, you just never know.
Yeah. So then also the other little story involving Serbia was that their foreign minister, I don't know if he's still the foreign minister or was outgoing or what, but as of a couple of weeks ago, he stood a chance of becoming the president of the UN General Assembly. Did anything happen with that?
He is the newly elected president of the UNGA, yes. He was, so the way that it works is that when it rotates, it goes by region, and so it was Eastern Europe's turn to have the head of the General Assembly, and it was between him and a guy in Lithuania. And he was elected. His name is Vuk Jeremic, and he is a young guy. I read, I think in The Economist the other day, that he's visited some absurd number of countries in the time that he's been foreign minister, because he's really been the international face of Serbia as Kosovo declared independence, as the independence went before the International Court of Justice. You know, I mean, he's been the face of Serbia, and now he will be the head of the General Assembly. And I think that a lot of people see that as a good thing for Serbia, insofar as clearly in comparison to its image, you know, 15 years ago, things have improved. And at the same time, it'll be interesting to see how that platform is used with regard, for instance, to the Kosovo issue.
Okay. It's a pretty big deal. I mean, I would think they're proud of their guy.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's certainly a big deal. You know, all of the press coverage I've read has said, you know, this certainly means a lot and says something about, you know, the status of Serbia on the international stage.
Right.
Yeah.
So they do, I mean, they do aspire to be kind of reintegrated into polite society, and
it sounds like
that's largely happened.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, no question about that they see themselves as, you know, a member of the community of nations. And there is a push and pull between Russia and the West with regard to Serbia. Nikolic, the new president, is seen as being friendlier to Russia than his predecessor. But there was actually kind of a funny press conference with I cannot remember his title, but he's a high-up guy in the government. And there were reports that Russia was pressuring the new government, the one that was recently elected, to not cooperate with the preceding government. And so the reporters were asking about this. And he said, you know, the last time a government was elected, which was more pro-West, we got the same, you know, pressure from the West, just from the other angle. And nobody came and complained to me about that. You know, it's like every time we elect a new government, you have, you know, a pull to the East or a pull to the West. And obviously, you know, the West and Russia have different values on a lot of things. But it was a reasonable point insofar as I do think that they feel pressure, you know, depending on what their political leadership is like. And it can come from their East or it can come from their West.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you, I think you wrote about a gay rights conference.
I did, yeah.
There not long ago?
Yeah, I was
in. What was that?
So I went to Albania last week. It was my first time in Albania. And it was a conference hosted by the U.S. Embassy in Tirana. And it was actually the very first U.S. government-sponsored LGBT event on foreign soil. So not, you know, a training at an embassy or anything like that. This actually brought together activists and embassy representatives from 17 countries throughout the region, largely from Southeastern Europe. But it was, you know, in that sense, quite a big deal. And I think that it was certainly a sign of how, foreign policy-wise, the United States is very much prioritizing LGBT issues in light of, you know, Hillary's speech in December and whatnot. And so it was, you know, it was certainly interesting to be there because it was in Albania, which no one ever goes to or talks about, and yet it was kind of this groundbreaking, I think, event for the U.S.
Well, I mean, not only is it a somewhat remote country in the view of a lot of people, I mean, as far as this specific issue goes, if you had asked me, you know, the U.S. government is going to do their first ever LGBT conference and wants to do it on hospitable soil, Albania is not one of the first three countries that would have sprung to mind,
I know. Yeah, it's true.
was that an issue, or was it just kind of held in like a hotel and kind of it didn't become like a local issue?
Yeah, so I spoke to several of the organizers, and I think that it was a coalescing of a couple of things. The embassy there, I think, has been very, very friendly to the LGBT movement, especially in Tirana. And that just is because there are individuals in the embassy who feel very strongly about the issue. They were just interested in planning this conference. And when they started planning it, they realized, you know, oh, this seems to be the first. Like, we seem to be breaking ground. But then I also spoke to a couple of representatives who pointed out that although LGBT rights in this region, and we can talk more specifically about that, although LGBT rights in this region are not protected in the way that they should be, it's at least Europe, and so you're not holding your first LGBT conference in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, or a place where, being gay might be criminalized, for instance. You know, on the one hand, it was an interesting place to hold it because it was sort of random and out of the way, and there are certainly issues with homophobia, but at the same time, it was still friendly enough territory, I think. There weren't billboards for the conference outside or anything, but it also wasn't a secret. It had a website, local media, local TV media came and covered parts of it. And as far as I know, there were no issues, although one embassy representative, and I quoted him in a piece that I wrote about this, said, you know, if we had made a really big publicity push about it, we might have faced more backlash.
And did any kind of declaration or anything emerge from the conference, or was this just a first kind of get-together?
Yeah, you know, it was largely a get-together. It kind of seemed to be serving two purposes. I think on the one hand, it was a chance to bring all these activists together so that they could be in dialogue with each other. You know, people from Ukraine and Macedonia and Moldova, you know, all these people coming together in one location. At the same time, I think that it was meant for U.S. embassy representatives from around the region to talk about how can we, as representatives of the United States government, especially under this sort of new push to prioritize LGBT rights, like what can we as embassy representatives do? And so sort of sharing best practices and also the activists especially, you know, sharing incredibly sad stories about what their life is like and the homophobia and other issues they continue to face in their countries. But as far as I know, there wasn't, any particular, end goal of, oh, we'll come up with a document. I think it was much more about bringing these people together and giving them a chance to share ideas and share experiences.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you for taking the time to give us this, to catch us up on Kosovo and give us this snapshot. I mean, it sounds like a place Americans should think about going. They love Americans there, right? You certainly can't say that about every country these days.
Yeah,
Is there stuff to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, there's a huge international presence here still because, you know, NATO's here. The EU has a rule of law mission here. The OSCE is here. I mean, everybody's here. You know, you walk down the street and you see all these trucks driving with various international logos. So they're very hospitable some people don't like the international presence for a variety of political reasons, but generally speaking, you know, people are accustomed to having internationals around, and there's a strong contingent of them here. And in terms of things to do, Kosovo is actually a very beautiful country. I went hiking on Sunday with a friend. We just spent the day out in Rugova Canyon, which is this lovely, lovely area up near Montenegro. And it sort of looks like you're in Switzerland, except you're in Kosovo.
Really?
So there's some really nice hiking, camping. And there are some very, very ancient, sites, maybe very, very ancient makes it sound like, you know, BC, not that old, but, there are some towns where there are some very beautiful monasteries, mosques, churches, a lot to see. And Pristina itself, I mean, there are good restaurants, there's a nice nightlife, it's definitely a very interesting place to visit. And Albania, I have to say, driving through on a bus is one of the more beautiful countries I've seen in a while. Which, unfortunately, their roads are not so great, and getting around the country is not the easiest. But I just kept remarking to my traveling companion, I was like, this is just so beautiful. You know, I just kept taking pictures out the window. So the region really is lovely, and I think there is a lot to do if you're a bit more of an adventurous traveler.
Do they like Americans in Albania as much as the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo like Americans?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I went running in Tirana two mornings very, very early, and I ran down George W. Bush Boulevard, so there's another one there. So he's remarkably pretty popular around here. So, you know, I
did. What did he do for Albania? I'm forgetting.
Well, I think that it's a couple of things. I mean, Bill Clinton obviously is very popular because he was the president when NATO intervened in Kosovo. And I think George Bush, at least this has been articulated to me by colleagues, is that he was supportive of Kosovo declaring independence and sort of supportive of this Albanian identity in the Balkans in 2008 in a way that was very pleasing to people. So I actually was talking with a colleague and I said, so who do you think is the most popular president in Kosovo? Do you think it's Clinton, Bush, or Obama? And he was like, oh, definitely Clinton, but Bush is a close second, which is, I don't know how many countries you could say that in, so.
And when does, if ever, does, like, American policy become an issue there? I mean, like, just since you've been there, have there been times when what America was or was not doing in some other part of the world really kind of mattered to these people in Kosovo?
That's a good question. I mean, when I was doing my interviews for the story about the Syrian opposition people coming to Kosovo, a lot of people said, you know, Kosovo will only go so far in that they very much do still follow U.S. priorities and U.S. foreign policy. And so I do think that they take their lead from the U.S. and will probably continue to do so. I can't think of an issue that's come up where I've heard people in Kosovo, you know, vehemently opposed to the U.S. doing something, and obviously I wasn't here at the time of Iraq or Afghanistan beginning or anything like that. But I think generally there is, and certainly at a governmental level, a lot of deference to the U.S. in terms of foreign policy. And I've spoken to people who work here for various U.S. agencies, and they say, you know, we definitely feel like people, you know, respect our guidance. You know, in that sense, I mean, I think it stems a lot from this desire to be included in the community of nations, you know, eventually have EU membership. They also, you know, are very careful in terms of how they are seen vis-a-vis the EU and the UN. And so, you know, they're careful on foreign policy stuff, especially, I think.
Mm-hmm. And does religion play a very conspicuous role in life in Kosovo?
So it's interesting because it is largely Muslim, and there are mosques everywhere, call to prayer. However, it is not, I mean, there are some women who wear headscarves, for instance, but on the whole, religion is just not, it doesn't dictate daily life, I think, the way it does in some other predominantly Muslim countries. I mean, it's a secular state, legally speaking. And I was speaking with a friend about how Ramadan is coming up, and I said, will it matter? You know, do I need to stock up on food, for instance, because will stores be closed during the day, et cetera? And she was like, oh, no, not at all. And so, you know, I think religion is certainly here, and it certainly matters to people. And on the LGBT issue, for instance, the community here, which is really just getting its feet underneath it because of some of the challenges it faces, one of its biggest opponents, or a group of its biggest opponents, are some more conservative, you know, Muslim leaders. But still, it's not conspicuous, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And you don't anticipate trouble on that front, or the LGBT thing? I mean, it doesn't look like that's going to become a big issue.
No, I'm working on LGBT stuff largely this summer for my organization. And what we're working on is actually kind of a comprehensive survey of the situation here for LGBT people. So, I'm currently designing surveys, for members of the LGBT community, and then other people, police, government officials, et cetera. And I think that the point is to sort of get a better sense of exactly how different people perceive each other. But the LGBT community here has articulated several things in my conversations with them or listening to them speak at events, that they're often told, you know, Kosovo has so many problems, like your problems just don't matter. You know, we're barely a country, we have corruption, we have all these other things, you know, who cares about you? And then they also hear, you know, this is even though, you know, you can be gay, just don't be gay out, you know, in your public life. You know, this is a conservative country, you know, just as long as you don't show it. So kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy, socially speaking. And so I do think that their existence here is tough, but they seem to be stabilizing a bit in the sense that they have a couple of organizations that work on their behalf. There have been some public debates and events about LGBT issues. And so, you know, I think it's a slow process, but it's definitely moving forward.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again for the report.
Yeah.
And I'll let you get back to hiking or whatever it is you're...
Well, I have to. It's the Euro Cup, and so I'll be watching soccer every evening from now until Wimbledon, practically, and then come the Olympics. So no Euro.
Now, is this a byproduct of living there, or were you already a soccer fan?
I generally like sports. I like big sporting events. I watch lots of them, even if I'm not, you know, a huge fan of the sport. College basketball being the one exception. I went to Duke, and so, you know, college basketball is a big deal. But it's just so fun here. I mean, I've now watched Euro Cup in three countries because I've been traveling so much. I've watched it in Macedonia, Kosovo, and Albania. And even though none of these countries have teams participating, it's still, you know, what's going on every night. You can walk through the streets of Tirana, and you can watch a game walking because every restaurant has a big screen showing it. And so you don't even have to sit down. You could just follow the game by walking along. And it makes for a nice time, especially in the weather, with people sitting outside at the cafes. So...
Okay, well, as your thoughts turn to soccer, mine will turn to the NBA Finals.
people are excited about that here, too. Maybe not quite as much, but they do follow it. Yeah, they do follow the NBA.
Wow, that intervention in 1999 did have an impact, didn't
it? Yeah, I can't get them. I've mentioned college basketball to some of my colleagues, and they're not as interested. If I was here during March Madness, I think I could, you know, get some excitement going. But
start a national movement.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Sayward.
Of course. Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.